Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
For an instant, the memory of that night hit her full force, but before she could dwell on its impact, Inga was at the door, holding it open and calling out, "Deidre Johnson, my word, get in here before you freeze to death. Child, what are you doing in Two Harbors this time of the morning?" Deidre stomped the snow off her boots on the outside doormat, then removed them in the entry. She walked into the kitchen and sat down at the table. Inga was already taking down two teacups and had placed a plate of peanut butter cookies on the table. "Oh, it's good to see you. How have you been, my dear?" Deidre looked at the older woman and was surprised to see that she didn't seem to have aged at all since the last time they met. "I'm good, actually very good. Life has taken me down a road I never dreamed I'd go. But right now, I'm up to my eyeballs in a problem." She went on to give a thumbnail sketch of why she was in Two Harbors. Inga seemed surprised Deidre was back in law enforcement, but stated her approval, saying that she had too much to offer society to be stuck in the woods. "Inga, I could use your help for a little while. I need a place to stay for a few weeks, and I'm wondering if my old room is still empty. I'd pay you room and board, and there wouldn't be any wild parties at night, promise." She laughed at her own joke. The older woman became animated. "I can't believe we might have time to spend together. It'd be almost like the old times, only under better circumstances. Of course you can stay, for free." Deidre laughed at her exuberance. "No, the BCA is footing this bill. You'll be paid well. I'll see to that. It's okay then?" Inga's reaction was more than a reward for Deidre. "I'm going to my cabin for the night and then to Thunder Bay tomorrow, but I should be back tomorrow night. If I pull in at 10:30, is that too late?" "Heavens no. You know my sleep habits. Nothing's changed since you were my neighbor. Deidre, it's great to be able to spend time with you again. I'll have a light snack ready for you when you get here." Deidre knew what Inga's light snacks were like. She anticipated a wonderful stay, even if she gained a pound or two. "One more thing. I have a dog, a pretty big one, I'll need to bring with me. Is it possible he could stay here?" Inga looked surprised. "I'm allergic to dog dander, but years ago my husband had a hunting dog. He fixed a wonderful kennel off the garage. You never noticed, I'm sure, because I've planted clematis, which climbs the fence. It looks like an arbor most of the time. Your dog would have access to the garage that has an insulated sleeping area. We can put a heat lamp in there if you'd like." And so that problem was taken care of with little fuss. Deidre was back in her office at 10 o'clock. When she entered the room, she couldn't believe the change. Coffee was brewing in a pot on a stand Jill had scrounged from another office. The desks had been rearranged to make for a better traffic pattern. A calendar covered the surface of her desk, and a coffee mug stood full of sharpened pencils, highlighters, and pens ready for use. Deidre sat down in her swivel chair and saw a note neatly printed on a legal pad. "You have an appointment tomorrow at 1:15 p.m. with Henry Muzio, Grand Chief of the Anishinaabe Aski Nation, or NAN." On a separate card was listed the chief's name, the name of the head of the nation's guns and gangs unit, as well as the address of the chief's office. She looked at her desk calendar. Neatly printed on ink in the square for Friday, November 22nd, was the same notation. Deidre couldn't believe what she was seeing. Just then, Jill walked in the room, and Deidre noticed that, with her hair under control, she had numerous piercings in each ear. "Well, what do you think?" Jill asks. "Will this arrangement do? I've called the Border Patrol to facilitate your getting through customs. Both sides are aware you'll be coming through about 9 tomorrow morning. You'll still need your passport, but you should get through without a hitch. You can bring a gun with you if you're packing, but they'll want the serial number and the number of your permit. I notified the head of NAN's gun and gang unit, so he knows the nature of your visit. He said to bring a copy of Dr. Coster's report. I asked that he set up a separate meeting with the tribal police so you can request what assistance you would like. That meeting is at 3 o'clock. You should be back to the U.S. border by 5, which should get you home to Two Harbors no later than 7:30, 9 if you stop for dinner along the way. If that's your intention, where would you like to eat supper? I'll call ahead and make a reservation for you. Jill stood looking at Deidre, an expectant smile on her face. Deidre was flummoxed by her efficiency. I really hadn't thought that far ahead. I'm planning to have a snack with a friend when I get back to town. Let's skip stopping for supper. I'd just as soon get home. By the way, thank you for all you have accomplished today. I hope I can provide enough for you to do so you don't become bored. Oh, don't worry about that. I always find enough to do to make time fly. Did you find a place to stay? If you want me to, I can track down a decent place for you to lodge. I've plenty of connections. Did I hear you own a dog? If you do, I have a friend in Knife River who owns a pet care service. She'll walk your dog once a day, make sure it's fed, watered, and we'll spend an hour with him so he doesn't get lonesome. Would you like me to take care of that? Once again, Jill stood with the same expectant smile on her face. That would be fine. His name's Pete. He's a black lab and will be staying at Inga Olson's place on 9th Avenue. Thank you for all your help. I don't know how you've gotten all of this done in such a short time, but thank you. Naturally, I won't be in tomorrow. Do you want the day off? Oh no, Jill answered. I'll find plenty to do. Still have some equipment to get, and somebody better be here to answer the phone if you receive an important call. I'll set up your email account. Do you want me to set up Facebook for you? It might come in handy if you want to contact a large number of people at a time. How about LinkedIn? Deidre turned down the social networking sites, but knew she'd need an email account. I'm going to leave early today, she told Jill. I have some packing to do at my cabin, and I want to be rested for tomorrow. I can cut across on Highway 1 to Highway 61. Then it's a straight shot to the Canadian border. Jill nodded. Remember, you can't take your dog across the border unless he has a veterinarian-signed paper showing all his vaccinations are up to date. Deidre smiled to herself. Is there anything she doesn't think of? Chapter 10. It was still light when Deidre drove up her access road and stopped near the back door of her cabin. Pete came bounding out of his doghouse and slathered her with affection. She ruffled his ears and talked baby talk to him. He raced away, his excitement getting the better of him. Deidre laughed as he plowed through 6 inches of snow, slipped on a hummock, and rolled over 3 times before gaining his footing. That night, the cabin felt especially cozy, and Deidre disliked the thought of having to abandon her paradise, if only for a few weeks. But she remembered the body she'd found, and all remorse vanished. She had a job to do, a compelling job, and she would do it well. Deidre was on the road by 7:30 the next morning. Her trip to the Pigeon River International Bridge, the border between the United States and Canada, was uneventful. She pulled into the Canadian Customs checkpoint with her passport in hand. The guard checked her ID, stamped her document, and ran his finger down a list of names attached to his clipboard. His finger stopped midway down the list, and he waved her through. No matter that he hadn't asked her if she had a gun in her possession, she had not felt the need to bring one with her. On November 22nd, the sun didn't rise until after 7 o'clock, and it hung only a few degrees above the horizon. Deidre looked at her watch, 10:30. She calculated she had about 6.5 hours of daylight remaining, which meant she'd be driving home in the dark, something she didn't relish. The thermometer in her car registered -4 degrees outside, a record for this day. Will-o'-the-wisps of steam rose from Lake Superior like specters that danced and swirled. They were the result of contact between the Arctic cold air and the surface of warmer lake water. The winter sun shining through the haze made the scene even more inhospitable. By noon, Deidre arrived at the port city of Thunder Bay, the Canadian counterpart of Duluth Superior. In the distance, she could see towering grain silos standing along the harbor docks. Rime-covered boats were being loaded, many of them salties, ships that would be traversing the ocean to distant continents. She stopped at a small cafe and ordered a sandwich and a piece of carrot cake. When the waitress returned with her order, she remembered she had forgotten to order coffee. The waitress returned with a scowl, a cup, and coffee pot. She set it on the table and left without saying a word. So much for your tip, Deidre thought. But when she made ready to leave, she left a toonie on the table. A $2 tip was more than what was deserved. From the cafe, it was a 20-minute drive to the NAN office. At least that's what her GPS indicated. But the instrument hadn't counted on a traffic accident at one of the intersections, and so Deidre was delayed for a half hour. She arrived at the front desk with barely 5 minutes to spare. After checking her credentials, the receptionist led Deidre to an office down the hall, knocked on the closed door, opened it a crack, and announced Deidre's arrival. She heard a man's voice say, "Send her in," and the receptionist motioned for her to enter. Henry Musio greeted Deidre warmly, taking her extended hand with both of his. He was in his mid-40s, was tall, and very good-looking. "Your secretary called yesterday, asking if we could meet today. She's a very persuasive lady. I'd like to meet her sometime," he chuckled, and Deidre instantly thought she would like him. "Come, sit down so we can talk. The head of the Guns and Gangs Unit will be here any time now. Our meeting is back-to-back with one he had scheduled, and he may be running a little late." Chief Musio had just uttered the words when someone knocked on the door. A man who resembled the chief in many ways walked in without waiting for an invitation. "This is Joseph Walken. Perhaps there's significance to his name." Henry laughed at his own joke, one she figured Joseph had heard more than once. Joseph shook Deidre's hand while he looked squarely in her eyes as if judging her spirit. Henry sat down and motioned for them to do the same. "Your secretary said you had information that might be of interest to our tribal council, information about a homicide in your town. What assistance will you be expecting from us?" His tone was not at all condescending, only matter of fact, and Deidre felt no veiled hostility. She removed a folder from her briefcase and opened it, producing copies of Dr. Koster's report. Before handing it to the men, she reviewed how she had found a naked body huddled under a bridge and briefly explained the condition of the corpse. Then she handed them the copy. Deidre anticipated that they would question why she was interested in the Anishinaabe Aski people, and she had highlighted Judy's supposition that the victim may have been of Cree Indian ethnicity. Henry spoke before he looked at the paper Deidre handed to him. "Your secretary faxed these to us yesterday. She included a note saying you were prepared to begin working on this today and requested we do some footwork before you got here. She sent copies of the girl's fingerprints as well as the examiner's x-rays of her dentition, and she indicated you'd be willing to stay an extra day if needed. The two of you make for an extremely efficient team." Deidre didn't have time to answer, which was all right, because she wouldn't have known what to say. Henry and Joseph paged through the report and concentrated on the areas she had highlighted. "We understand why you want to speak with us. Are you aware that at the present time, more than 600 Anishinaabe Aski women, what you would probably call Cree, are missing, many presumed dead, many presumed to be trapped in the sex trade?" Deidre's jaw dropped. She had no idea the problem was so extensive. Joseph continued, The average age they enter the sex trade is 14, with some as young as 10. Henry's jaw muscles bulged as he fought to control his anger. He said, "Many are girls who come from dysfunctional homes. Others have run away for trivial reasons, and some are literally kidnapped. They are transported down Highway 61, a river of bodies flowing to Duluth, where they are sold to sailors on board ships in the harbor. Many are taken overseas, servicing the sailors on the boats throughout the journey. Many are thrown overboard as the journey nears its end. Estimates are that a supplier realizes profits of over $250,000 per year." Henry leaned toward Deidre. "Are we interested in what you bring us?" "Absolutely." "Will we cooperate?" "To the fullest." "Is this an isolated case?" "It's the tip of the iceberg." With those words, he went silent, but Joseph began to speak. "There are few statistics to support what Henry's told you, because most of the victims are killed before they can speak out. Thunder Bay's police spokesperson has gone on record saying he isn't aware of any problem. However, the Ontario Provincial Police, headquartered in this city, recognizes the crimes against our people. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the OPP, and the Canadian Border Services struggle to combat human trafficking, but still, it's a trade that flies under the radar. The wilderness border is as porous as a sieve. Anything can leak through, especially in the summer when the waterways are open to tourist canoe traffic. What can we do to help you in your investigation?" Deidre sat in deep contemplation for several moments. "You can begin by helping me find out if our dead girl is from your nation, and if she is, what her history is. If we do find an answer to that question, then we must find out how she reached the town of Silver Bay. Finding that answer, we must then locate the party or parties who brought her to Minnesota. Then we go after the killer or killers. Without realizing what she was doing, Deidre was formulating the sequence of a plan she would follow to the end of the case. Her dead girl deserved to be heard in a court of law, if only by the silent testimony of her wounds and death. We appreciate your desire to move forward on this issue as quickly as possible. The information from your secretary was passed on to Nan's chief of police, Charles Freeman. He'll meet with you at 4 o'clock today, and I believe he has some answers for you. Joseph will accompany you to his headquarters and help you find your way around. Charles is a good man, hardworking, and very intelligent. He is eager to meet you and to seek your cooperation on this case. Is there anything else I can do to facilitate your work? Deidre sensed the meeting was over and stood to leave. She extended her hand. No, not right now, but I hope the lines of communication will remain open between my office and yours. The Grand Chief smiled warmly as he held Deidre's hand for a moment. After speaking with your secretary over the phone, I don't think I have a choice. Joseph Walken escorted Deidre through the maze of hallways to his car, and together they rode over to the Nan Police headquarters. On the way, Deidre phoned Inga to tell her not to expect her home that night. Then she called her friend Terry, who owned a bait store a few miles from her cabin, and asked him to stop by and check on Pete and to give him some food and water. Even if she was done with her meeting by early evening, she didn't want to drive 150 miles home in the cold and the dark. By the time she finished her calls, Joseph had parked his car in an underground garage. They took an elevator to the fifth floor of the headquarters building. Again, she followed Joseph through a maze of hallways until he walked into one of the offices. The receptionist looked up from her work. "Joseph, how are you today?" Not waiting for an answer, her gaze swung to Deidre. "And you must be Deidre. Welcome to Thunder Bay. Your secretary called and left a message for you. She has made reservations for your stay tonight at the Valhalla Inn. It's only a few minutes' drive from here and is one of our best lodgings for the money. You'll be comfortable there." Deidre was beginning to wonder if Jill was some sort of psychic. She wasn't accustomed to having someone being one step ahead of her all the time. She smiled and took the paper from the receptionist. Joseph was holding the door to the inner office open and motioned for Deidre to go in first. A black-haired man stood by his desk, a welcoming smile on his face. Deidre thought he looked like a man who could have modeled for one of those calendar pictures of a royal-mounted policeman. "Deidre, so good to meet you. I feel as though we've already met. Your secretary faxed me a brief bio of you. Your work experience is more than impressive, and I, for one, am delighted to be able to work with you. I'm equally impressed with your secretary's initiative. She pointed out what might be most useful to meet your needs. You're lucky to have her working for you." Deidre found herself mumbling something about being grateful for her assistance, but she really wasn't quite sure. Charles, the Nan chief of police, bypassed any small talk and got down to business. "We know your schedule's tight, so let's get to the point. You're aware, I'm sure, of the monumental problem our staff is facing, and it's taxing our resources, both in personnel matters and financially. For decades, centuries would be more accurate, our women and girls have been preyed upon by men who have used them as prostitutes. But the problem has become increasingly more sinister because they're being coerced in more systematic ways by gangs and criminals. There are so many girls missing, it's difficult for us to stay abreast of the situation. Fortunately, we have made considerable progress since receiving Dr. Koster's report yesterday." With that news, Deidre became acutely focused on his words. "Of the 600-some missing females registered in our files, our computer system was able to quickly select those between the ages of 14 and 19. That brought the number of possible leads down to 347. Selecting those who had type O blood further narrowed the search to 326. Considering height, we narrowed the field to 118. We were getting closer." Deidre was getting fidgety in her chair, and she wished that Charles would skip the process and tell her what they had found, but he continued. "Next, we checked the dental x-rays you sent us against the records of the 118. Unfortunately, most of our missing women and girls come from conditions of extreme poverty. Many have never seen the inside of a dentist's office, and so no records exist for them." Deirdre's hopes began to plunge. In our case, we were lucky. Your victim comes from a moderately successful family. In her record file was a complete set of dental x-rays. Fortunately for us, unfortunately for her family, we found a perfect match. Charles handed a paper to Deirdre. This is the information you're looking for. She quickly scanned the page. Name: Anna Joyce Woodsong. Deirdre read more. Age 16 years, 9 months. Judy had nailed this one perfectly. Height 160 centimeters, weight 50 kilograms. She wasn't used to metric measurements, but a rough calculation mixed with a little guesswork led her to the figures about 5 foot 3 inches and a weight of about 110 pounds. That seemed to fit the corpse, although she appeared to be much lighter than 110. There were other data on the page, but Deirdre's eyes were too full of tears to read. Joseph cleared his throat. We've located Anna's parents, and they'd like to meet with you this evening. Charles will accompany you to their home and sit with you during your meeting. I'm sure there are questions you'll want to ask her parents, but we ask that you be respectful of their feelings and their heritage. They are solid people who have been held up as an example by our people, but they are hurting deeply right now. I know what they're feeling. You needn't worry about my ability to respect them. I've been there myself, she said as she wiped her eyes with a tissue. I'll be gentle with my questioning. After retrieving her SUV and checking into her hotel, Deirdre ate a light supper before Charles arrived to take her to visit Anna's parents. Neither of them said much on the way, each facing his and her own sense of dread over the uncertainty of how the visit would go. He pulled into the driveway of a modest home. This is it. Before we go in, I think you should know that her parents are keenly interested in their heritage and in preserving some of the old ways. Not that they're trying to live in the past. They're very progressive. They simply want to preserve their native language and some of the traditions. Under other circumstances, you'd find them to be interesting people. They walked up the sidewalk and Joseph rang the doorbell. It was answered by an attractive woman who looked to be in her late 30s. Deirdre could see a distinct resemblance between her and the picture of her daughter she'd seen back at Charles's office. Come in, please, she invited them. Deirdre noticed the lady's hands were trembling and her voice quivered. She and Joseph removed their shoes in the entry and followed the victim's mother to the living room. This is my husband, John Woodsong. I'm Mary. Thank you so much for taking the time to come to our home. She sat down next to her husband, and there was a moment of awkward silence. No one seemed to know what to say. Finally, Anna's father cleared his throat. We understand you have confirmation our daughter has been found dead. Deirdre shuffled her feet. I was called to a suspicious site in the town of Silver Bay last week. It appeared that something had been struck by a car and thrown off a bridge. When I investigated, I found your daughter's body under the bridge. I called in experts from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension of the state of Minnesota. Their medical examiner, who was also a forensic anthropologist, determined that her death was a homicide. She also believed the body to be that of a Anishinaabe Aski girl. That's why we contacted the NAN officers to seek their assistance. From their forensic data, a positive identification was made. Deirdre waited for a response, and another long period of silence followed. Did she suffer? Mary asked. She held her head high as though bracing for a slap across her face. Deirdre didn't tell the whole truth. I think death came painlessly. She thought it probably had. Hypothermia would have set in and the girl drifted into death. Deirdre was not about to go into what had transpired before death released her from her torment. Anna's father asked, was she badly broken from the impact of the car? Deirdre took a deep breath. She wasn't hit by a car. I'm sorry I left you with that impression. Unfortunately, your daughter was accosted by an individual or individuals and was left for dead. She didn't go into details. Mary began to weep into a towel she had been worrying. John clenched his teeth so hard the veins in his neck stood out. I have a few questions to ask you, if you're willing to share with me. She needed information, but she also wanted to move the conversation in a different direction. How long ago was it that your daughter disappeared? Mary Woodsong tried to speak, but each time she would begin, the words were cut off by a sob. Finally, she shook her head and looked at her husband. John was able to speak, although he had to stop repeatedly and take a deep breath. "It will be 6 months tomorrow." He paused to control his voice, then continued speaking, looking nowhere. His eyes were blank. "We had an argument that day. I insisted that she go to tribal classes that night to study our native language, but she wanted to go to a concert with friends. I said no. We had words. She didn't come home for supper, and we thought she had gone off with her friends to the concert, but later that night we called her friends. They said the last time they saw her, she was walking alone on a path in a park by the lake. We called the Nan police, but they found no trace of her. We haven't seen her since." He paused again. "When can we see her body?" "I'm not sure. Your daughter's remains are at the BCA lab, where they are still looking for clues as to who her killers might be." She wasn't lying. "Here is the number for their central office. They'll have the details you need." She handed a card to Mary. "Do you know if your daughter had any involvement with older men?" Mary glanced at her husband. She said, "No, I'm sure not. Her friends were all her own age. She was a good girl, officer. No trouble at all. It's just that she was exerting her independence lately. She was growing up and wanted to make her own decisions." Deidre nodded her understanding. "Do you know anyone who might have wanted to hurt your daughter?" "No one. She was popular and friendly with everyone. Why would anyone want to do this to her? And how did she end up in the States? Do you have any idea?" Deidre had to admit that she didn't, but in her mind she made a vow she would find the answers. "I want you to know that I appreciate your taking the time to visit with me," she told the grieving parents. "I won't say I know how you feel. I'm sure your pain must be beyond comprehension. I promise you I'll do everything I can to bring your daughter's killer to justice. I also promise to keep you up to date on what we're discovering. I may not be able to divulge everything we're doing for the sake of the investigation, but I'll be in contact on a regular basis. Again, thank you so much, and I'm sorry for your loss. I'm sorry." Joseph stood up and Deidre followed suit. John escorted them to the door. As they were walking away, they heard his fist pounding on the inside of the door. "That was difficult," Joseph agreed. Sleep did not come easily for Deidre that night. She dreamed she was chasing a formless figure through the woods, but the snow was knee-deep, dragging at her every step. She dreamed that she finally collapsed, exhausted, while the figure lurked in the shadows of the tree line. By 6 the next morning, she had packed her few belongings and checked out of the hotel. The ride home was long.
You've been listening to Episode 5 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors, here on Literally from the North Shore.